A special thank you to Rabbi and Mrs. Goldman for opening up their home and giving us their home to have this event here tonight. We really appreciate it. Thank you. So I'm up here just to explain what the format will be like tonight. First, Rabbi Gross will give a little words of introduction, a little bit of psicha, and then afterwards the panelists will all just introduce themselves and talk a little bit about their areas of expertise, things that they see in the community, in their line of work. And after that, we want to open up to question and answers. When we did this event in University Heights in Beechwood, the feedback that we got was there wasn't enough time for question and answers. The panelists spoke a little too long. So we want that they're just going to speak a little bit, and then everybody's more than welcome to ask their questions. We did put a little index card on your seat with a pen that if you don't want to ask a question, you could write it down on the index card and hand it up, and we'll read out the question. There's also just a sheet on your seat as well that there's no personal information on there, but if you could fill it out after the presentation, it's evaluation on the presenters and on what we're doing. It's just, it could be very, very helpful for us. So without further ado, Rabbi Gross.
Good evening. I'd like to first take this opportunity to thank Rabbi Hellman and his staff at NALA for putting together this event that I'm hoping will be, it was already once in the other neighborhood, but I'm hoping will be the beginning of a breakthrough in the way we deal with mental health issues in our community. Just want to share a few thoughts and my perspective in this area. There's a very interesting Meshech Chachma who questions why Torah tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu was told that there are going to be six Ari Miklat, six cities of refuge for someone who murders by mistake, B'shoigeg. So he runs there and he's safe. And Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu there's going to be three before they get into Eretz Yisrael, on the other side of the Yarden. And there's going to be three in Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe Rabbeinu went and designated the three that are not in Eretz Yisrael, because he never entered Eretz Yisrael, even though they would not work until all six were designated. And the question that's asked is, why couldn't it have gone that when Moshe Rabbeinu designated the first three, they started working, and someone who killed B'shoigeg could run there and be safe? Why was it necessary for all six to be designated before they could be activated, so to speak? And the Meshech Chachma says the following thought. When a person kills B'shoigeg, he murders by mistake, so we send him to this Ir Miklat. It's a holy city. The Levium live there. It's a type of rehabilitation. He is immersed in spirituality, so he shouldn't come ever again to such a terrible sin. However, how long is his sentence? How long does he have to stay there? So the Torah says he stays there until the Kohen Gadol, the high priest of the time, is nifter, dies. That's it. It could be 40 years, it could be a day. No one really knows when that person's going to die. So says the Meshech Chachma that he's put into the Ir Miklat, and every morning he wakes up with the hope that today he's going to go free. He doesn't know how long his sentence is. He's not here for 20 years. They put people away for 20 years, it doesn't work. This person wakes up every morning with the tikva, the hope, that's his words, the hope that he could go out today. The problem was that Hashem already had promised that the Kohen Gadol of the time, Elazar, is going to be living at least for another 14 years until they divide up Eretz Yisrael. So that means if someone would go into this Ir Miklat today, he knows he's not getting out for another 14 years. To go in and wake up in the morning with no hope of leaving that day, that's too much. That's too much of a punishment for a person, and therefore, it's not going to work. And that's an unbelievable thought. And that's really, in the world of mental health, that's what happens. A person wakes up in the morning with no hope of going on. And I'm not going to talk about what the panelists, I'll leave the expertise to them. I'm just going to talk in a general oifen. Generally, people in mental health situations that are suffering, they push it, don't have hope. They think this is the end of their world, there's a dark cloud. And that, says the Meshech Chachma, is something that is very, very hard for a person to be able to handle. It's very hard, they feel very alone. And my experience is that sometimes, because of that, they end up isolated. It could be it's their own setting that up. But the point is that that's where they are. And people need to understand that. If you want to understand mental health issues, that's the aleph beis of it. The aleph beis is a person waking up in the morning with no hope of getting out of their little jail, so to speak, of the situation that they're in. And we as a community, we need to get together and give support to such people. In this week's parsha, it says that a person will become very poor and he'll sell his land. And he has the option of redeeming it. Says the pasuk, let's say there's a person who has no one to help him redeem. He has no relatives to help him redeem his field, to give him some financial help. Says the Gemara, is that a possibility? There's a possibility that a Jew doesn't have a relative who could help him? Says the Gemara, Yeshle, of course he has the Einai Raitza, but the person for whatever reason doesn't want to help him. So I saw today from Rabbi Yosef Nechemia Kornitzer, he was a Rav in Krakow, he writes that that's the way it works with people. When someone's successful, when someone's on a high, he has lots of friends and relatives to help him. But when a person is mach, when he's poor, and we'll say in our context, we're not talking about monetarily, when a person's down and out, he doesn't have anyone to help him. Again, sometimes it's because of their own isolation, but that's the metzius. They end up isolated. And people either don't want to or don't know how to help. And there's a big stigma that we have in our community. And I'm going to go out on a line here and be bold. There's a big stigma that we have in our community when it comes, and I don't mean our little community, Cleveland, general from community. There's a big stigma when it comes to mental health. We spoke about this at our Rabbanim's meeting last week about this issue, about the stigma. And we, as friends and neighbors, and Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh L'Zeh, we have to break out of that stigma. And we have to make it that just like we would help someone who's in trouble financially, someone who's in trouble, Chas V'Shalom, with a physical ailment, a physical sickness, we have to make it our business that this is absolutely no different. This is no different than any other situation anyone is in. And we have to make it our responsibility to get rid of that stigma. And Michael, may Rabbi Helman take a little longer than I was given here, but I wrote a few sermons called the 5-minute sermon, but the last three are called 30 days, so settle in. A few years ago, they said the panelists are going to be shorter here, so I can go longer. A few years ago, I was in Eretz Yisrael with my wife. It was about 7 years ago, and we went to the famed Mekubel Rav Gamliel Rabinovich, very close friend of my father-in-law. And I asked him for a bracha for a woman who was suffering from anxiety and depression. I asked him for a bracha. And he was standing by a chair, behind the chair like this, and he started banging on the chair, and he got very upset, and he said, "A bracha? Zol zinem in trufot. Let her take medicine, take care of herself. What a bracha, I should give her a bracha?" So I told him, no, she takes medication. She takes care, she still wants a bracha. He calmed down, he said, "Oh, if she's taking care of herself, then I'll give the bracha." And that's what it's about. This is an ailment, this is a real thing. It's a real thing like everything else we deal with. But unfortunately, the stigma's there. I see so many people in my office, and I tell so many different people, If we would all just get together, every second house on every block, somebody is hiding from somebody else. If we would just get together and support each other, get rid of that stigma, we could do so much. No one would wake up in the morning with that hope, without that hope, I'm sorry, of being getting out of their jail. No one would be vim ein le'ish goyel. And I'm so happy to see that Baruch Hashem Nala has taken that and they've moved forward with it, and Baruch Hashem, bringing awareness, and especially with a forum like this, and perhaps, Rabbi Hellman, you'll be Michael me, but I think maybe if we could find, for the next event, people who are willing to go come in public and say their story, what we call normal people. I'm not like people, you look at them and say, okay, of course, they're the mental health people. They're the normal people, who are going through or have gone through. It's going to be a big step for those people. But if those people could get up, we could find such people to make an event, that would really break the stigma and show that we could get together. Because if we could work together, we could do so much more. We could give so much chizuk. It would take half my problems off my shoulders if there were other people that are sharing, neighbors and friends, just like we share in every other problem that we have with each other. We should be able to share in this together. And Be'ez Hashem, this is a beginning. I wish everyone a lot of hatzlacha. We should be zeicha together, of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Lazeh, that no one should ever feel alone. No one should wake up in the morning and say, life is hopeless, there's no one that I could turn to. And Be'ez Hashem, if we bring simcha to each other, we should be zeicha to the greatest simcha that Kol Yisrael will ever, ever experience with the coming of Mashiach, the end of our tzaras, b'mheira v'yameinu. Amen.
Amen. I'm going first. I just can't see everyone.
They want you to stand up.
Yeah, I guess to stand up. I was hoping I would. It's like my dream. Oh, I get to stand here.
Yes.
So, hi. Oh, this is not fun. Okay. Can I? No. Okay. Hi. Just gonna bring my paper.
I have props. So one thing I wanted to just show, my name is Tova Hershkowitz, just to introduce myself, Tova Hershkowitz. I work at NALA. For those of you who've called, that's who you speak to me. And I do mental health referrals and support in NALA office. And I'm a social worker, so that's two things. This is our pamphlet that we have up here if you want to take one at the end. It just tells you a little bit about what we do, some of the services we provide, and some of the help that we have given to some people. I'm just going to read through here because I think it's really well done. One thing that we do is the teen mentorship program. We have lots of different programming for teens. We have a safe space called the Living Room. That's our most recent and most exciting project. And we have two primary mentors who work in that setting. It's on Warrensville, and it's just an amazing place, truthfully. And we also have mentors who do not work in that space. We have mentors in the community, people like you, who are just loving, caring people who are there for someone who just needs love and care. Really nothing more than that. They're not therapists. They're not supposed to be clinical. They're not supposed to be anything fancy, just giving people attention. And so that's for girls, for boys. We have different divisions. That's one thing we do. We also do referrals, which is what I mentioned before. So when someone calls and they ask for a referral, they speak to me. If you prefer to speak to Rabbi Hellman, that's cool too. He's back there, that's Rabbi Hellman. And he is also available to kind of like field the calls. What we do in that department is we can make a referral for anything mental health related. So that's a therapist, psychiatrist, psychologist. We'll talk a little bit about the difference between those, I guess throughout the evening. But sometimes people call us and they're not really sure what they need. So since I have a background being a clinician, I take that into my role there. And if someone says, I have anxiety, my question is, who diagnosed you? Or do you have a diagnosis? Or are you being medicated or treated for it? And that's an important piece because sometimes people say, no, I guess I just thought I did because X, Y, and Z. And that's important too. And then that can help us lead to presenting concerns and getting the help that that everyone deserves. So that's the referral piece. I think I mentioned everything. Oh, we also forgot the most important part. We try very, very hard to help match you with somebody who is on your insurance, because that's a huge piece. If you're already paying for insurance or you already get insurance through the government, like, why not just use it? So I make it my effort and use up so much energy and time meeting people in their offices, in their workplaces, seeing the toys that they use in play therapy, seeing the modalities that they use so that I can make a better referral as opposed to just someone who I heard that was okay, or maybe that's what they specialize in. So I really can make a better referral based on that experience, meeting them. Another thing we do is advocacy, which means that we do, that means that if, let's say you're not sure what help you need, or you don't know really how to access it, that I can call a therapist with you, or I can call a psychiatrist with you, or be in touch with them at the same time, and then advocate for you that this is a service that you would be benefited by, or that would be really helpful for you in further functioning. Support means that we help support people, not monetarily, sorry, but we help support people just in terms of their mental health. Sometimes people aren't really sure, am I the only person in the world who has postpartum depression? Am I the only person who has a son who's using, you know, substances or whatever, you know, and we just try and show you that there are other people and how to access help even for yourself if that's something you're struggling with. And we also have support groups, which is, it's one of our things that we're always trying to take new ideas and start new ones. We have one running now for parenting an explosive child, which has been a huge success. We're a bunch of months in, and we still have majority of the people have stayed on, very passionate, very excited, and really willing to share in a group setting. So that's been huge also, the support group piece that we try to provide in a safe and confidential environment. And then they're also run by clinicians who also we've met, we know work in a group setting, and those groups are free of charge. So actually all the services we provide are free of charge, but specifically the support groups we just want to help people access the help that they deserve. So that's a little bit about NALA. You can call us, the number's on the back. You can always call, leave a message. You can email us. It can be confidential. You do not have to leave your name. You can block your call. The most important thing to us, we don't need to take your name and number. We just want to help you get the help that you're looking for either you, for your children. We help any age. I got a phone call last week for a 4-year-old. I got a call the week before for an 85-year-old. So there's really no limits to that. So just a teeny drop. I feel like I'm talking for an hour. So a teeny drop about my background, just so you know, like, why you can call me. So I taught preschool for 10 years before I decided to work with the underdog and then switch to trauma and addictions. So kind of like an interesting switch. But so I have experience working with really little kids. And then when I was doing my master's, I started working in a hospital with very, very sick patients in a partial hospitalization program for mental health and for drug addiction. And then I worked with teens who are struggling with those also. So I really worked kind of like through everything. I worked in geriatrics for a little bit, so I really run the whole gamut, even though I look like I'm 20. But I kind of been around. So, you know, I still have the things that I appreciate more and have a lot more experience with. And I'll be honest with you when you call me if it's something I know or something I don't. But thank God, in my short time in Cleveland, I've made a lot of really good connections. Some of them are sitting in the audience. Some of them are sitting up here. And I'm just really grateful to help you guys access the help you deserve. So, and super impressed that so many people came. So, props to everyone.
Can you all see me there, or do I
no,
need to
you have
get
to
up?
I have to get up.
I get up.
Okay.
So hi, everybody. For those who may know me, or if you don't, I'm Hoodie Newman. I'm a social worker in the community for a long time. I've been at Yavna High School for, this is my 21st school year, actually. So I feel kind of old because some of my clients' kids are now in the school. But I've been there for a while. I've also been in private practice for about 15 years. The area that I really specialize in is teenage girls and young adults, female. So probably ages 13 to 30, female, is really my niche. A lot of work with teens, but in my private practice also, that young adult age, like 20 to 25, is a really great age group that I'm working with. And in my private practice, I see people outside of Yavna High School. So if I talk about any case examples on the later part of the program, don't assume it's all students at Yavna High School, because I really see lots of clients outside of Yavna High School. I always have to put that disclaimer out there. Not everybody I talk about is from Yavna High School. But my passion is really helping teens and young adults.
The latest thing that I've done recently, which I've been pretty excited about this year, was I became certified in EMDR training, which if any of you know what that is, it's a very specialized trauma training that it took us years to get Cleveland clinicians trained because all the trainings are on Shabbos, and we got a group of six from therapists together, and we got a training in the weekday, and it's been a really big step forward for Cleveland therapists, I think, because it's one of the most cutting-edge treatments for PTSD and trauma. So that's sort of my new passion, EMDR. Otherwise, I was asked to talk a little bit about like when is a problem a problem? I think that's the topic of tonight. That's really hard to answer because it's really always a case-by-case situation to answer whether this is a problem or this is not a problem. But I guess in really short, I can say earlier this year I did a training at Yeshiva Derech HaTorah for the staff, and I was asked to really conceptualize what are the top mental health challenges that teenagers face today. And I thought that was such a great question because, you know, the teachers want to know how to deal with things. And if I had to just briefly list the top five that I see in order of sort of numbers, in order of frequency, the first one would obviously be anxiety, obviously for me, I don't know about for you, but 30% of the population struggles with anxiety. So tons and tons of kids with anxiety, young adults with anxiety, in school it could be test anxiety, social anxiety, or just generalized anxiety, but anxiety is probably the number one issue that I see in my practice. The second one would be depression. Depression is still really, really up there as far as frequency of numbers. Third one's ADHD, which I've seen a tremendous rise of diagnoses in ADHD, and I have some thoughts about why that is, but I won't go into that now, but definitely seeing a lot more cases of ADHD in students today. Fourth one was eating disorders, because that's always sort of one of those sort of undercurrents when you work with teenage girls. Sometimes it's more prevalent. We can sort of have spikes. I've noticed trends, at least in Yavna, where I've worked. You know, there are some years where they're kind of dormant, and then there's some years where there's like this spike, and there's always the contagious factor, so contagion effect. So sometimes you see like it's sort of spreading, and that gets really scary when you watch it happen. But eating disorders are sort of always a constant in the background, sometimes more than other years. And trauma, we cannot ignore trauma. Trauma is really something that has been, I think, ignored for too long. Early childhood traumas, even the traumas that would not have in the past been considered like big traumas, what we call big T traumas, like those single incident, you know, terrible events that might have happened to somebody, but we're learning that the small T traumas, which means the really over the course of time, smaller traumas like neglect, bullying, things that occur over the course of probably even years can have the same impact, if not worse, than the single incident, bigger traumas that we used to think of when we looked at PTSD and the kinds of trauma diagnoses before. So those are the top five mental health sort of diagnostic categories I could name. But if I'm talking about teenage girls, I cannot forget the social stuff that comes into my office, which always takes up a lot of time, and there's always a lot of drama attached and a lot of pain. You know, I don't want to say drama. For teenage girls, their social lives are super important, and there's always a lot of stuff and challenges that come along with that for girls. And family issues is always, it's not a mental health diagnosis here, but those are probably the other two big topics that I see in my practice on a regular basis. So I'm happy to take questions as the panel continues, as the evening goes on, but that's in short, I guess, what I see in my work.
Hi, fellas. First, thank you very much for coming. What a turnout. It gives me a chizuk. You know, drives me and tells me, you know, what I do and why I do what I do. I'm a therapist in the Cleveland community. I deal with children, you know, 5 to, you know, 20-year-olds are acting like children. So, you know, the gamut, sometimes younger adults, but my prime focus is on children and adolescents, mostly in ADHD, a lot of anxiety and relationship issues. Niebuhr Academy, already 15 years, and Derech HaTorah, I'm in Yeshiva Derech HaTorah as their social worker, school social worker. I give trainings in schools. I take my experience as a teacher and blend it with my experience as a therapist and try to educate teachers that there's different ways, different interventions, you know, how to deal with our students, our children. There's another way. I've been around throughout the United States and part of Canada. So I've had really the privilege of meeting so many amazing teachers and principals that really, really want to help their children and really want to help their students succeed. and they just want to know how, and they just want to know, you know, best methods. I also write in the Mishpacha Junior, I'll give a little, push for that every other week, tell your kids to write. So, the Rav spoke about alleviating the stigma. If we bring this, when the children are young and teach them that it's okay to have a problem, it's just how we deal with it. The problem is when we don't deal with our problems, that's when it becomes a problem. The factor of hope, Larry Gross, I couldn't say it better. When a client comes to me, when a client comes to a therapist, when someone comes to you and you just tell them there's hope, I feel like 30% to 40% of the therapy is already done, where they feel like there's a way out of this, there's a light. Just one thought I would like to share, because really it's all about you, so we want to hit the road with questions. Early intervention is primary and it's critical. I've seen, and of course all the therapists can say the same, that when a client comes to you earlier on, the prognosis is so much better. You know, I'm just kind of thinking about some different cases that I've dealt with, different children I've dealt with. For example, with OCD, one child came in very, very far into it, very difficult. Of course, we dealt with medication and a lot of his relationship issues attached to it, and it just got very, very complicated. Rather, a 12-year-old, versus, I should say, a 12-year-old that comes in and the parents saw he's started doing some, interesting behaviors or some strange behaviors. They just, I think the bar mitzvah mode really motivated them, and 6 months later, he was a different child. So the difference of getting a child or the difference of coming earlier on is critical. ADHD, that's a big thing. When children go undiagnosed with ADHD and they continue getting disciplined and they continue being sent to the principal. I had there was one time there was a child in my class was drain around, was walking around after recess, principal found him somewhere in the building, brought him to my class and said, "Oh, Yalis, he needs to sit in my office tomorrow 5 minutes." I said, "Of course." Baruch Hashem, I remembered. I told this Shmuel Shlemi, "You need to go to the principal's office now." He looks at me and he says, "Where is the office?" He didn't know where the office was. I don't send kids to the principal. When you send kids to the principal over and over and over, they gain this negative identity. It's very, very hard to undo an identity. Everything's possible, but again, early intervention is critical. And I'm a teacher, so I bring visuals. I had a child in second grade. His undiagnosed ADHD got so bad where he didn't have friends and he couldn't learn. And he was hitting people and he was disturbing conversations. And I walk in one morning and he's giving out his business cards.
Cassie.
Can we see?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can you read them out loud?
I can give you, "I am the dumbest." No one but him could have, thought about this and written this. And of course, I was going around the other side collecting his business cards. It's been probably 4 or 5 years. I hold on to these cards and I bring it to presentations because this is what ADHD or undiagnosed ADHD looks like. And this is what we need to treat. And this is what we need to treat early on. So again, thank you, Nala, for hosting this. I appreciate being here. Thank you.
So if we could start, we'll start the questions and the question answers part. But if we could start with Mrs. Newman, you speaking about eating disorders, could you help? We had one of the questions was, how do I able to tell signs if my child, a teenager, is starting to show signs of eating disorder?
Okay. I actually have a checklist in here. If anybody wants to come up at the end, I can give it to you. But just off the cuff, there's a difference between dieting and eating disorders, even though they can start out looking the same. So a student or a girl who decides she wants to lose weight can think they're just going on a diet and take it too far, and it can tip into an eating disorder for those who are more vulnerable to it on a biological level. How it actually looks different is that a girl who's on a healthy diet will be
You know, losing weight in an appropriate way, meaning eating three meals a day, eating some snacks, will be able to handle an occasional, you know, not healthy food without guilt or anxiety or stress, will feel pretty positive about the changes that are happening to her body, and eventually say, oh, I kind of like how I look, will not have an obsession about their body weight and their body image and food and eating like those with an eating disorder would have. So to shift to what an eating disorder looks like, a teenager with an eating disorder will typically be obsessed with every food that goes into her body, how many calories she is burning to get it out of her body, what she will eat, what she won't eat, how thin she is, what the scale says. Her day will be made or broken by what says on the scale that morning. So if the scale is a half a pound up, she will have a horrible day. If the scale is a half a pound down, she will have a much better day. It is a complete obsession with food, dieting, exercise, body image, usually coming along with a very distorted body image. So even when she gets really thin, she still thinks she's fat. No matter how many people will tell her how thin she is, she will not be able to see that. It's literally a distortion. She will look in the mirror and not see what other people see. It's not that she's pretending. It is a mental illness. It is not just, you know, dieting a little too much. It's literally where a switch flips in the brain from being able to think about food and body image and dieting in a healthy and a normal way, and to the point where there is complete obsession, complete fixation, and it usually leads to depression, wanting to die, not being able to live with themselves. I had a student that I was talking to very recently with an active eating disorder who said the eating disorder voice in her head, because it's usually like this negative voice, which, you know, kind of tells them not to eat. The rule that she has from the eating disorder voice in her head is never ask for food, only eat what you are forced to eat, and never ask for more. And that is the rules by which she lives her entire life. That is all she cares about and thinks about. She doesn't care about the fact that she may not be able to have kids one day. She does not care about the fact that it may kill her. None of that matters as much as losing the next pound. So it is extremely dangerous. It is the most lethal mental illness that exists. One out of every six people die from eating disorders, whether from the medical complications that happen from the eating disorder or whether from suicide. So it is the most deadly mental illness out there. And it is a serious disease.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yeah. I just wanted to add one thing. Not that Hoodie needs me to add anything.
No, please.
I just wanted to just to point out that for any of the disorders or mental illnesses or anything that we're discussing or describing, it's so, so important to just remember that if someone is either you or somebody you know or care about is struggling with some type of anything, it's something emotional and something mental, not something that you can answer in a practical way. So if how Hoodie just described it, it brought me to that, because if someone's saying, oh, I feel like I'm still super fat, and you're saying, no, you're so skinny. Clearly they're super skinny. Clearly they're super skinny. And if you look at them, you can see that, and any objective person would think that they're not objective anymore. So that's just an important piece, that even if your kid has ADHD or you're not really sure and you're like, but of course you're super disorganized, they're not going to see that. They're going to see, this is my version of organization, and this is the best I can do on my homework. This is the most I can sit in class. This is the most that I can behave on the playground. And that really is true. That's a real true fact for them, but it's not healthy or, you know, working. So that's just one component. Sorry.
Anybody, before we move on to the next question, anybody have any comments or questions?
Can you comment on eating disorders in boys and also eating disorders on people who aren't skinny?
Yes, great question. I'm going to start with the latter because that's such a myth, which I'm glad you raised. Mm-hmm. People think that those with eating disorders are super skinny. There's different types of eating disorders, obviously. The three most common ones are anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating disorder, which is compulsive overeating. Obviously, people with compulsive overeating are not going to be super thin. Mm-hmm. People with anorexia, we'll get to in a second. People with bulimia, by the way, are typically of average or above average weight. They are not super thin. They typically are not. People with anorexia might be your stereotypical skeleton-looking person, but most of them are actually not either. It is not a person's body weight which will diagnose a person as having anorexia anymore. Years ago, it was a certain body mass, and now it's literally the psychological features of how they think about food, body image, weight loss, that is actually more important diagnostically than how much weight they weigh on the scale. Because every person's body has a certain set point weight that they have to be at to be healthy, or that their body naturally gravitates towards. And so every person's goal weight in eating disorder recovery, for example, is radically different.
My client with an eating disorder right now, her goal body weight has to be 150 pounds because until she hits that weight, her eating disorder thoughts are so strong, and nutrition is actually the medicine to turn those thoughts off. So she needs to gain enough weight to sort of flip that switch back. And so her treatment team, they tried 135, it wasn't enough. 140 wasn't enough. She has to get to 150 before she can actually recover from her eating disorder. So don't look at body weight anymore when you think of eating disorders, and never make a comment to somebody who has an eating disorder, something like, oh, but you're not even that skinny, which is actually a comment somebody made to my client.
Oh my God.
And she was like, oh my gosh, I'm dieting all over. I'm going back to my old ways because I need to be skinnier. And to answer your question about boys, I don't really work much with boys, but just the facts out there are that 10% of people with eating disorders are boys, 90% are female. And for boys, it's typically the boys most commonly who are like wrestling or on sports teams where they have to make certain weights, but not always. It could be boys who are also struggling with the same kinds of issues that might cause a female to have an eating disorder. You know, it's a way of controlling a situation, controlling their life. It's a way, it's a maladaptive coping mechanism, basically. And boys can fall into it also, though less frequently as girls, but it does exist, 10%.
Somebody wrote in a question. The Rav spoke about helping people who are struggling with mental health. How can we help? So if before the Rav answers that, or anybody
else? My job
is over. Your job is over. So actually, mental health is something called peer-to-peer. And we do get calls from people that we started a list in the office where people that were suffering with a certain, whether it was depression, it was anxiety, postpartum depression, they have offered their help to help other people. That they say, if you know somebody else that wants a peer-to-peer, wants somebody to talk to, not necessarily a clinician, just somebody to actually connect with, and you know, I'm not alone, there's somebody else that went through it. We do have a small list in the office, and when people ask for that, we could try to help connect people and give them that hope that way. But more on a clinician level, do you want to answer that, Chaim, or else?
So just to clarify, how you can help as a non-professional, is that what you mean? Okay. You know, I feel it's important to listen and not to judge. You know, we're so quick, and we're all a victim of this. You see a child in a wheelchair. Oh, what can we do? You know, we get the elevator key, and you know, here, why don't you help him? You see a kid, you know, off the wall, you know, circling his desk, or exhibiting all the wonderful behaviors of ADHD or even anxiety. You know, we get upset. We tend to, you know, judge quickly. So we need to stop judging. We need to start normalizing. Right, this is part of what people go through, and just, you know, if something that we've gone through, or we know people that have gone through, and they don't mind that we share that, to share that with them, and it could be helped.
We have support groups, right? I was gonna mention the peer-to-peer support has been very, very successful. We have. I think I have a VIP longer list than Rabbi Hellman does, because a lot of people recently have said, like, please have people reach out to me. And some of the matches that we've made have been so, so successful. So if you think that could be helpful for you, or if you have experienced something that you think could be helpful for someone else, please reach out. And again, you can always be anonymous until someone reaches out to you. It doesn't have to be, you know, that we publicize who you are. And then also we run support groups, which are also that peer support. It's run by a skilled clinician, but it's also people just like you.
Rabbi Ellis, just based on what you were saying, let's say you have a boy and they have a younger boy, elementary school age boy, whatever, ADD, anxiety, whatever. Is it helpful to, or is it hurtful to, for the siblings to be aware and understand, and this is what they're struggling with, close friends, you know, for the boy, is it helpful for the boy or the girl, whatever, to normalize, and therefore everybody kind of is like, oh, this, you know, this is my thing, this is what I deal with, just like the person in the wheelchair, or is it embarrassing and shameful, and is it not?
It's an excellent question. I think it really depends on the sibling, and it depends, you know, on the friends. you know, if you think that, yeah, this kid is gonna like just, you know, knock him again, I wouldn't say anything. In fact, you know, Sarah Schoenfeld, that's her name, Schoenfeld has a series of books. You know, my friend, the ADHD, my friend, the volcano, my friend, the warrior. So those books are good. I actually spoke to her personally and I applauded her for it, because what happens is if you take that book and you start, you know, reading it to your children, or you're reading it to your students, so that normalizes it. And then you may have a kid say, oh yeah, I have it, and yeah, I took my medication this morning, you know. So, because, you know, and you'll see how many kids' hands go up. So it becomes, yeah, you know, something that this is what we live with. But that's really important, because as this child grows older, you know, if we want to, you know, build strong men, then we have to teach children, and we have to teach youngsters at 7, at 10, at 12, it's okay to have a problem. It's okay, as long as we deal with it.
I just want to answer the question from a preschool perspective, that when I was teaching preschool, and as I mentioned, at a certain stage in my teaching career, I decided that I wanted to treat the underdog and really like hone in on what on their needs. And so I always had the kids who needed testing or assessments or really intervention of some sort. And sometimes I would call out those kids and say, okay, so we're about to have circle time, and I know sometimes it's hard for you, so you can hold this ball, you know, halfway through a Shema or whatever it was. And none of the kids got jealous. None of the kids got upset, because they knew that when they needed something, they got it. So I found that was the biggest telling point, the biggest, I don't know what to call it, but, you know, the so telling for me, because every kid, if they get what they need and they're getting extra attention, you know, I was just talking about this with a fellow clinician, that one of the kids in the family has very, very needy, like, needs and therapy and this and that and whatever. And the sibling said, it's not fair. You always take her out to therapy and you never hang out with me. So now what do I do? Like, am I supposed to take my daughter to therapy also? I'm like, no, you're supposed to hang out with your kid. Like, that's a thing, like, to hang out with your children or something. So, like, that's the kind of thing, if you give them what they need, they're not going to need other things. They don't need therapy. They just need whatever it is that they need, which sounds, obviously I'm oversimplifying parenthood and everything, but that's really like, if I could just say that and then the evening could be over, like, that's really what it is. So
if I can just piggyback on that, you know, I once gave a training in Applewood out on the west side. I was giving all these interventions to these, you know, those social workers there and therapists, and one young school social worker came up to me and said, well, how can you do that for these kids, for this one boy, for Steve and for Johnny? Everyone else is going to be jealous. Mm-hmm. So I want to debunk a myth here. Usually, as long as the child you're talking to, again, he doesn't have a mental health issue, and he could accept it, most kids can accept, Shlomi needs it, you don't. Mm-hmm. You know, fear is not equal. Mm-hmm. So that, and second graders, third graders, they get that, they understand it, because they also understand what normative behaviors are, or typical second grade behaviors are, and behaviors that are not. You know, 80% of the class, or 90% of the class, is sitting in a seat or standing next to his seat in my class. And this one boy or two boys, they're making circles, or they're getting, you know, breaks every kind of, you know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes. So they will see the difference. They will kind of, they just realize, even without you telling them.
If I could just weigh in now. So now that all the professionals gave their non-professional opinion, but I give you my professional opinion. So I try to push a lot in our shul, and there's mostly women here, but especially for men, we interact a lot. There's a lot of socializing. We don't tell this to the women. We just go to Davin. But there's Lamaisa. There's a lot, you know, there is socializing going on, and people see each other. And, you know, if someone doesn't show up for a while or someone misses a few weeks, like, give them a call, see what's going on. I have lots of times people come to me as the rabbi and say, hey, what's going on with him? I haven't seen him. And, okay, as my job as a rabbi, I say either I've been in touch with him or I thank you for pointing it out. But at the same time, reach out to him. Say, you know, many times I just tell someone, I'm just here for you if you just want to talk, if you just... A lot of times people need that safe place, and that's part of the stigma. Rabbi Donner once said, from England, he once said at a convention, what's the definition of a nudnik? that a nudnik is someone if you ask him, Vos Herzog, what's going on, he starts telling you. That's a nudnik. So, you know, that's you're not really interested when you say, how you doing? You know, everyone's doing great, right? But because no one's really, really listening to how are you doing. And that's part of if people feel comfortable that when they are able to open up to someone, they won't feel judged, they'll feel understood, someone's really listening to them. You know, when it comes to neighbors, community, you know, I haven't seen you a while, let's go out for a cup of coffee. You never know what's going to come out of that. And even if nothing comes out of it other than the friendship and the connection, that in itself is healing for the person. So as a community, we're talking a lot about the children, but as community and adults, we just have to open up our eyes. Everyone has very busy lives and very busy families and a lot of things going on, but if we open up our eyes a little bit, that will go a long way in being able to identify people who are having issues and how we could connect to them.
Thank you.
Okay, just I'm not sure there's even an answer to this, but when you have, I feel like there was already mentioned that a kid in a wheelchair, people recognize that that's an issue. And also with learning disabilities, I feel like our schools have come a long way in recognizing learning differences. But when it comes to the social, emotional, that type of thing, our kids, when you say the normative behavior and giving more slack for kids who behave, sometimes we're finding a system where the normative from the top is so much more limited. That nice way to say it, then what, let's say we as parents who are all here tonight because we want to help our children, and they're fighting the system, and they're in a system where every single day they're knocked down for their non-normative behavior, which is really a social emotional behavioral difference, not necessarily chutzpah or whatever it's still called. Defiance.
You know, you're preaching to the choir, so I agree, and that's why I love to have the opportunity to speak to schools, and especially principals and educational leaders, where they can impact change, and they need to impact change. I'm going to present for, you know, a group of principals and instructional leaders in Houston, Texas, because we need really appeal to the heads of the school, 100%. And that kind of trickles down to our teachers. But you should know, I was at the Tormasura Convention. The Bayman and teachers and many principals, they really, really want to help their students. I had a discussion on Shabbos with the Rebbe about a complicated situation, the child ADHD and then being reassessed. The Rebbe comes over to me, finds me, like amongst like 1,600 people, and says, Rabbi Elisabeth, I called the mother tonight. She has the appointment. So these are, you know, they're really in it, you know, for the good, and they want to make change.
Do the schools collaborate on this issue? Do they talk to each other?
No. They're supposed.
Next question.
You think they should? They shouldn't. I don't think they should. I rarely ever speak to the social workers in the other divisions of our school, other than who's in Yavna High School. Like, there's three campuses. The elementary school social worker, I think I met once in 9 years that she's there. Forget about other schools. We're all bogged down with literally just seeing students and putting out fires and dealing with cases.
So that's super important. But sadly, I meant the professionals, rabbin, et cetera, with the leadership of the schools. In other words, what you're saying is it's so important that there has to be alignment. You know, you need the therapists and the rabbin and the teachers and the principals, division principals and heads, to all be on the same page.
On a global level and on a local level, 100%.
Right.
100%.
One thing that you had said, Rabbi Ellis, which I really strongly agree, and it's like even people need to nip things in the bud. Like you were saying, if you see signs, one of my children got anxiety about something, and my personality was the type to be like, snap out of it. There's nothing to be anxious about. But I realized it wasn't something that this child would snap out of. And we saw it quickly, we got help quickly, and this was years ago, and thank God we were able to find the source and take care of it. And now if he's feeling anxious about something, he will call, and, you know, the person who we set him up with, and he totally overcame it. And we could, if we would have just like pushed it under the rug, it could have developed into something horrible. So I really
you deserve a round of applause. Thank you.
I just kind of want to go on what you just said. Just to go back to the topic, like the actual topic of the evening is when is a problem a problem? And I just want to, pinpoint one of the things that you said that for you, it wouldn't impair your functioning to be a little bit anxious and it probably wouldn't even faze you and you probably wouldn't even be anxious about whatever happened. Let's say he forgot his lunch. Okay, so you make it work. You're a little hungry. You borrow a snack. You be resourceful. You make it work however it is. There are some kids who really can do that. There are adults who can do that. And then there are people that are like, I'm at a red light and I'm one step off of suicide. So, and that's fine also. It just, does it impair your functioning or does it not? So I would say that's like a huge piece to look at when we're defining when is a problem, because if even, and the reason it's so perfect that you brought that point up is because for you, you would have been fine, but we're not judging your son as you, we're judging your son as your son. And then he accessed the help he needed. And then if he needs a little, we call it either a tune up or a booster, right? So every therapist calls it something different. But if they need every three to six months, if they need help, if every 3 to 6 years they need help and they can access that help, that's huge. You're giving them a tool for their life. So right now they're three and can't really sit still at circle time, get them help. And then it can come back around when they're in fourth grade and they still can't sit still in Gemara class. And then they get that tune up and then they're ready to go. So I think it's really important to see if it's the person that you're looking at, if the identified client, as we call it, if their functioning is impaired. That's like a huge guess.
And if I can add, when they get married and they see they're going from one to thing to the next, right?
Yep.
And they remember, you know, therapy did something.
I feel like oftentimes we are putting out the fires, whether in the house or in schools. When can we get from reactive to proactive, whether like in schools or at home? Like, where can we get that education that everybody could be kind of on the same page and so that we don't have to wait till all these, you know, all these crazy cases come up in so much dysfunction.
Right. And we did have a few more questions that came in along the same lines that you're asking. Is that how do you know when a child having meltdowns at home, fighting with siblings or being difficult is more of a mental health problem or just being difficult? So this is sort of interesting.
I guess from a teenage perspective, it can sometimes be really tricky, especially for parents, because certain normal teenage behavior can sometimes look dysfunctional, like they're moody. I mean, think of all the negative stereotypes you have of teenagers. They might be really disorganized, they might suddenly become terribly irresponsible, even though they were like a responsible child once upon a time, isolate themselves in their room for hours on end, you know, playing their devices, shutting out other people. Every one of those symptoms can be normal, teenage developmentally appropriate behavior, or it could be a sign of a bigger problem. So, you know, teenagers need space and they may hole up in their room for a few hours and there's nothing terribly wrong with them. Or it could be a sign of withdrawing from other people to the extent where it is one of many symptoms of depression and that's the one you're seeing. So you as parents know your children the best. Other than maybe their friends when they're teenagers. Their friends know them really quite well at that stage in their life. But as parents, your gut instincts are probably on target. So if you're sensing that something might be off or something doesn't feel quite right or there's this symptom or two that you're not really sure if it's normal or not normal, get in touch with a school social worker. That's your easiest way because we're free and we're accessible and we have voicemails instead of having to schedule with a therapist who you have to pay for, clear your insurance with. Just get an initial screening by a school counselor. That is a very easy, quick way to just screen out for, is this an issue that I need to worry about? Is this something that the school counselor can intervene and do a few sessions with her and we can get the child back on track? Or is this something that really needs further intervention? So it's really a case-by-case situation. You've got to look at it, follow your instinct, ask for some assessment if you need, and then sort of go from there.
Also, just from a parent perspective, because I work with a lot of parents. When you work with kids, you naturally work with parents. Is that just to go on what you're saying, from what you're describing, it sounds like some of what's happening is not comfortable for you, even if they are age appropriate, even if it's developmentally okay, even if you would call the school psychologist and they would say, what do you mean your kids are gems? If it's not, if they're not feeling like gems to you, then there are ways for you to access help with that. Either having dinner be, you know, more flow more easily, or if laundry day on Tuesday isn't working for you, like how can you organize your schedule differently? And therapists can help with that. And so can, truthfully, so can medication. If you're, I mean, I'm not a med pusher at all, but if that's the kind of thing that you could use, like something just to cut that tension a teeny bit when it's bedtime or when it's bath time, or when your six kids all need help with dinner at the same time and they all need to be fed, that's a lot. Carpool is crazy. Like, if it's not okay for you just because it's okay, like you would call, let's say you would call Hoodie and she would be like, everything's amazing. It doesn't then give you permission, like negate the importance of you accessing help if you need it.
Right.
Just to clarify.
One other piece I would say, you know, for teenagers in particular, there's a fantastic parenting book that just came out in the last year, I think. It's called Untangled by Dr. Lisa DeMore, which literally focuses on, every chapter is a different sort of normal, appropriate developmental piece of adolescence. And then it ends with, when is this problem? How do you know when it's become problematic? She literally answers that question at the end of every single chapter. So if you want a great just guidebook for parenting teens, I would highly, highly recommend it. Untangled, Untangled by Dr. Lisa DeMore. She's fabulous.
She teaches at Laurel.
She actually contributes to, I think, NBC News in New York. She flies in once a month. She's their adolescent specialist. She writes a column in New York Times on teenagers. She's a Cleveland native, and she is phenomenal.
For
so,
teenage boys and girls?
She focuses mostly on teenage girls.
Okay.
Yeah, sadly. I can give you an, if you want a book for any teenagers, which is one of my all-time favorite parenting books, it's called Yes, Your Teen is Crazy by Dr. Michael Bradley. It is phenomenal. Boys, too. He's a father of teenage boys. Yeah. He defines crazy as actually not being crazy the way we think it. It has to do with the rewiring that's going on in a teenager's brain. He uses the term crazy very loosely, but that's boys and girls and fantastic overall parenting.
What's his name again?
Dr. Michael Bradley, B-R-A-D-L-E-Y. Yes, your teen is crazy. He actually has a book for teens saying, yes, your parents are crazy, that goes along with that. That's really an awesome book, too.
That's so cool, because it's like perspective taking.
Yes, total perspective taking.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm wondering, what do you recommend if, let's say, I work in education, if you see that a student is clearly, you know, struggling with something, their obsessive thought patterns, and they get caught on one thing and they can't get out of it, or and either the student or the parent or both are resistant to getting help. Like the student says, well, I don't need to talk to someone because that means I'm crazy if I have to talk to someone. And obviously we try to normalize it to the degree possible, but you know, what do you recommend for that? And obviously it's different for younger kids versus
right.
teenagers, but.
So what age group are you referring to?
K through 12. 12 is now for age 22 in Ohio.
I mean, I guess
you could do the 12.
I'll take the teenage range. That is one of the biggest challenges, I think, actually, as a clinician for me, you know, starting out in the field thinking I can help everybody because I was so idealistic once upon a time. And then I learned that the parents are the gatekeepers to getting the child help. And as much as I can want a child to get the help they need, if the parent isn't on board, because that's really an issue, nothing will happen. They will not get the child help. They will not take them to therapy. There will be no more support. There will be no assessments. There will be no treatment. At that point, I've learned to say, I will work with what I have. If I have a willing and interested teenager, I'll see her in school and I'll do what I can, even though I can't do the amount of treatment that a child would need out of school, but I'll do what I can just to get access to the child somehow and try to help them. But taking it one step further, if you have a teenager who doesn't want the help, with teenagers, you cannot force help on anybody who doesn't want help. You can't make a teenager do anything they don't want to do without their buy-in. So the minute I sense I am working harder than my client to help them, I usually call them out on it and I say, I feel like I'm working harder than you are to help you, and I need to know that you're actually invested in this process, or else why are we wasting our time? You can go back to class. And usually they'll be like, no, I want to stay out of class. Please, 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 I'll talk about anything. Just pull me out of class every day or as much as you can. But typically there has to be some buy-in. And if I have a student who is very clearly not invested and doesn't want to change anything, and for example, your example sounds like OCD, I find that particularly frustrating. I had a student with that once who had no interest in leaving the rituals. They were very comforting. They eased her anxiety. They made her feel better. And the thought of giving up any of the OCD behaviors was so terrifying. She had absolutely not just no interest in fighting it. She fought the therapy. In this case, the parents actually did believe she needed help and fought the parents on it. And it was just a nightmare of fighting, trying to get a kid help who didn't want help. And at this point, we have to step back and say, whenever you're ready, there'll be help waiting for you, but you have to want it. So sometimes you cannot help people who don't want to be helped, and that's really hard, at least for me.
Yeah, for younger kids, I'm just going to add, it's magic, and it's free, so listen. When the child comes in, of course, you need the parental support. But a lot of times, the parents will come in and say, fix my child, you know. He doesn't listen to me. He doesn't go to school on time. He runs around. He doesn't follow my directions. I talk to the child. I get to know him. Because even children, you need that buy-in. And I find out what he feels is wrong in his life. And I'll go through his school day and his life at home. And I'll say, well, I don't have any friends. Oh, okay. So I'm going to start with the friends. I'm not going to start with the listening to mom or listening to dad. Once I start with the friends, he's on my side. And that's my key.
Another question that was written in, maybe Rabbi Gross or Rabbi Kalski could address this. Can you address the correlation between mental health struggles and religious struggles?
Rabbi speaks first.
I'll give the professional opinion afterwards.
No. In short. In fact, it's really interesting. I am mesmerized by OCD. And if you take a look at the DSM manual, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, that's where, you know, that's the Bible of disorders. They give case examples of meat and milk, where Orthodox Jews get kind of OCD-ish with, mixing basar b'chalav. That's quite interesting if you figure out what percentage of Jews are in the world and what percentage of Orthodox Jews are in the world. And it's in the DSM, that's all over the world, you know. But there isn't at all, however, it's like for OCD, and we'll talk about ADHD in a moment, there's maybe more to latch on. Baruch Hashem, we have a lot of halachas, we have a lot to live by. And we know that's, you know, because that's the guide to life. However, in order to live a successful life, there's a lot of halachas to keep. So OCD will be able to catch on and latch on to more. But it doesn't mean that OCD is more by religious people. ADHD, I mean, we're the people of the book, right? There's only one way of learning Chumash. It's reading Chumash. Yes, I understand there's visuals and computers, and I've heard it and seen it all. But the bottom line is, if you want a child to be successful in reading a pasuk of Chumash or a line of Gemara, he has to look inside. If he's working too hard to focus, so he's going to get frustrated. And when he says, I'm not interested in learning, he doesn't mean I'm not interested in learning. Well, learning's not for me. No, that's not what he really means. He means, this is just too hard. It's too hard for me to learn this pasuk versus my friend, you know, who has, you know, much easier time. So therefore, the frustration kicks in. It's not that ADHD is more by religious people. It's just, I think that we have more again for it to latch on.
The correlation that I see is more about, I think, pain. I think a lot of times where it shows itself in religious or non-religious, I should say, probably, or throwing things off or angry at Tyro or at Rabbeim or at Rosh Hashivas, is usually because something went on earlier that was painful, that there's an association. And again, I think someone said someone else will look at it objectively and say they don't have anything to do with each other, and the person's perception might have been incorrect. But like Rabbala said, if you can't read the line of Gemara, you can't read the Chumash. So in his child's mind, whatever, I don't want to say abuse, but whatever trauma he felt by not being able to do it, failing the test and so on and so forth, somewhere along the line, there's going to be a build-up, and it'll come out later, and that's where the anger comes out. The anger at the parents, the anger at the Rabbanim, anger at the Rashivas. So, again, it's not a correlation specifically with religion, but a lot of times that's where the rebelliousness comes and the anger comes. And, you know, hopefully if someone gets some treatment and works through it, you know, they could get back on track.
But along those lines, I just want to add, in the secular population as well, instead of, let's say, being angry at their rabbi or being angry at the system, they'll come home like, you know, looking like a punk or something, or tattooed across the arm. Whatever, I guess, is not acceptable as a social norm, they will rebel against.
That's true. Yeah.
Self-esteem. For a child with ADHD, or I guess any other mental health diagnosis, they know they're different, which affects their self-esteem. How can we help them with building their self-esteem?
Find other areas in their life where they can become competent and feel great about themselves. Competence breeds confidence. So if a child feels good about themselves in one area, outside of school, outside of, you know, like the typical ways of performing in society today, which is for students, it's usually at school or at sports, let's say. Find something else that they're good at, find an interest, cultivate it, develop it, and keep, you know, as parents, we have such a huge opportunity to build our children's self-esteem by, you know, constantly telling them, you know, that they're great, catch them being good. Don't always focus on the negative, focus on the positive, all those sort of more common parenting
tips. If I can throw a book out, because you started with the books, The Strength Switch. So that's supposed to be a really good book. And really the thesis and the idea of the book is to focus on our children's and students'
positive
strengths.
Yeah.
What I do with my child with ADHD is he knows what he has and he knows he's got it pretty severely, and I equate it with the medical things that we see, the wheelchair, the diabetics, and so he doesn't see it as a self-esteem issue. He sees it as a clinical diagnosis, like some other poor kid's got some horrible disease, and they kind of learn to live with it, and it's just something that he has, that he was made, and he has to learn to work through it, just like everything else. So I really don't think that this kind of ties into the discussion that we had earlier about how much of this do you tell your children, is that if you do and you just make it matter of fact, it shouldn't really play that much of a role in their self-esteem, because you use it, I mean, the diabetic child doesn't have a self-esteem problem typically, because that's a medical diagnosis, and you just make this more of a medical diagnosis than a mental health problem.
With a child with ADHD, though, or in a class, they're constantly saying, no, sit down, or turn around, or do something, because they're constantly fidgeting. So it's a lot of negativity that they're getting. And
depends on
that.
Then they're not
also depending on the parent, like it's just, I feel like that also could affect their self-esteem. It's like they look at themselves as a problem child, rather if they're not a problem, that they do have an issue that we have to figure out how to work through it.
You know, for teenagers in particular, ADHD is one of those where I think when I talk to teenagers with ADHD, there's actually a book called The Gift of ADHD, where I think it's important for them to see that there's really a lot of strengths that come along with ADHD. You know, they tend to be more, sometimes more creative, they have more energy, they're more, you know, they can think about multiple things at once, so they can multitask. Obviously, depending on if it's mild, moderate, or severe, it will impact whether they can see the gifts and utilize the gifts at this point in their lives or not. But I describe it as a difference in the way the brain is wired rather than a mental illness, because it's really not. It's a neurobiological difference, and it's very different than some of the more stigmatized mental illnesses out there. So I think, you know, kids can, especially teenagers, can appreciate if I say to them, I know in high school this feels like the worst thing in the world to have, because the ADHD brain wants to do exactly the opposite of what your teachers want you to do every single day. So sit in class, focus on one thing at a time, listen to the teacher, don't look at everything else going around the room, and then go home and do hours of homework is what your school, your teachers really want you to do when you're a student. That is completely contrary to what the ADHD brain wants to do. So it's really hard to get those negative messages all day long that you're not doing enough work and you're not focusing and you're not behaving and, you know, all that. But once you get out of high school, and I have the luxury of saying that because they're closer to graduation than when they're in elementary school, I say just wait 2 or 3 more years and your ADHD can really work for you. You can be that capable, you know, chair lady of the Chinese auction, or, you know, with your creativity, you can start your own business and do whatever you want in your life. You can soar using ADHD as a, you know, as a forward momentum. It'll push you forward rather than seeing it as a deficiency. But in school, it's really hard. So we acknowledge that, we validate that, but we can encourage them moving forward.
That's the whole strength-based thing anyways. The whole concept of any strength-based treatment that really, really works for kids is being able to tell them, like, when you're older, you could be the CEO of a company, or I could see you being an amazing architect, or you'll be a great, I tell this to kids all the time when they're trying to like negotiate. I'm like, you will be the best lawyer in the world. For right now, I need you to do X, Y, and Z, but that will be really great for you in the long run. And it's really true. So if you can, even as a parent or as an educator, if you can kind of focus on that piece, that's golden. It'll be golden for you also, because then you're not as frustrated.
I think Cody, you said earlier, I believe you might have said that you have a theory like why ADHD or ADD has, I'm curious what your theory is.
I guess my thoughts, no research on this really, but just from being in a school for...
You have enough research.
From being in a school for over 20 years, you know, in my earlier years there, we had a handful of ADHD kids sprinkled through, okay? And then as the years went on, I started seeing this like trend where there were just more and more and more ADHD kids. Yeah. In every class. And there was one year where it finally hit me full blast and I had a look at it, where I had 8 kids in one class with ADHD. Now, can you imagine what that teacher was going through trying to teach? She had, I think, 14 kids in the entire class, 8 of whom had ADHD. It was a nightmare. I mean, the teachers were not able to teach. The principals were up in arm about the behavioral issues. And I'm looking at this going, what's going on here? So I started looking at case-by-case situation, like, each and every one. Is there, you know, too much diagnosis going on? And I think that the one area where things can get misdiagnosed, even though in general I think it's the opposite, but we are lucky that we are catching it earlier and diagnosing and treating kids earlier, is that early childhood trauma can change children's brains in the exact and make them look, behave, and act almost exactly the same as kids with ADHD. Trauma can impair their ability to focus, pay attention, be able to concentrate, sit still. And so their brain is almost rewired sometimes by childhood abuse or neglect or, you know, severe trauma of some sort, that it will turn them into ADHD-like kids. And then they are teenagers who might look like their same peer who has ADHD because they're exhibiting the exact same behaviors. And what we'll find is the kids who have sort of more pure, real ADHD will respond really well to medication, they'll do fine, they'll actually be able to function well. And the other kids who it's really trauma-based, medication won't touch it. And so they are acting out all over the place and they have the symptoms that look ADHD-ish. So sometimes there is that misdiagnosis, I think. Not that we shouldn't even diagnose it because those kids really have all the symptoms of ADHD as teens, but the roots are so different.
Yeah.
And so the treatment has to be different. They need trauma treatment. They don't need ADHD treatment.
So how do you know what the roots really are?
A therapist has to get to know what's really been going on for that kid.
But if it was, let's say, childhood or infancy trauma, the child may not be able to
talk about it.
Or even know, like, that's what the trigger is. I mean, that's what the root is.
Right. So in a school setting, I'm obviously limited in getting full family histories and things like that because I have whatever presents to me in my office. Sometimes I will, you know, when I can, I'll call a parent in and get some background. In a private practice setting, that's one of the things we look for immediately in the initial assessment. I always have a parent in with the teenager for a session, and I always ask about early childhood, any traumas, developmental history. I try and get whatever information I can because it's really telling when the mother says, you know, I had postpartum depression, I was not able to manage my children, they lived with the neighbor, and I wasn't there for the first 2 years of their life. You know, that's a severe case, obviously, but, you know, I had a case like that once, and the child didn't even know, like you said, that there was this major history. And that affected her attachment style, her ability to connect in relationships, and all kinds of things that could look like ADHD later. So, I don't know if I'm being clear, but...
Or even going through a case history, sometimes being able to say, you know, she was totally fine until she was 5. Well, did you move? Was there, like...
What happened at 5?
When did you see a decline? When did you see something happen?
We said we're going to finish by 9:30. Two questions came in that relate to Shidduchim. I want to get to that, but we'll take one more question you have to ask, and then we'll try to wrap up with the Shidduchim question.
Thank you so much. So I wanted to ask about being proactive in terms of, is there a way that we can prevent some of this, or is this completely just probably just a mix, I assume, but what can we do from our perspective as parents to be as proactive in avoiding all of this, you know, all this starts little and becomes this whole thing, you know, what can we do to prevent, what are the best things, what are your best ideas?
Such a great question. Go.
Number one, shalom bias. as Rabbi Gross might attest. Mm-hmm. I think Rabbi, what was it, Rav Palm, who said 50% of having good, healthy children is shalom bias. So if you are having marital issues, work on them, work on them, work on them, because you can prevent a lot of issues that your children may develop later just as a result of things that might be going wrong in the house because of lack of shalom bias. On the other hand, you know, mental illness is really, any major mental illness is caused by a combination of three factors. It's genetic vulnerability, which you cannot help. If you have, you know, in your genes, there's a family history of certain mental illnesses, you're not going to be able to prevent that as much as something else, like, which the next one is environmental stressors, which if you have a happy, healthy home and you work to mitigate environmental stressors in your child's life, meaning major traumatic events or things that are preventable, not everything is preventable in life, but if you can try and give your kid a happy, healthy environment, then hopefully they won't have the environmental stressors. And then the third piece that factors into the development of a mental illness is inborn personality traits, so temperament. So like if you have the kids who are really internalizing kind of kids who keep in everything in, and if they're frustrated, they, you know, don't know how to verbalize, they sulk, that, you know, they are more prone to develop, like as teenagers, the internalizing disorders, the depression, the anxiety, the eating disorders. If you have the kids who are more externalizing in the way they cope with life and stress, the ones who are angry and may even yell and scream, they're actually usually the healthier kids because they get it out. And they're not sort of hanging on to it and holding it in and having it weigh them down and turn into a mental illness.
Do you think that by talking to kids proactively about, like, is everything okay?
Sure,
kind of stuff,
sure. Develop a relationship with your child is,
we don't,
is golden.
Like, it's not, that doesn't, like, trigger, like, oh, is there a problem? Like,
no, you're not going to give them ideas.
It's better. It doesn't give them ideas.
Nobody develops a mental illness because you talked about it. Nobody.
That's great. Mrs. Kaifman, you had your hand up for a while. You want to
ask? Oh, well, it was before when you were just discussing the, when you were in the school and with the classroom and the kid being able to sit. I mean, you were talking specifically about ADHD. I just wanted to bring up one point about everybody being on the same page. In terms of dealing with this, it's more in terms of boys. Wait, I just have to remember my you know what, maybe at the end.
I have a question in that classroom. So it's true that the one second grader will realize that he doesn't have abundance of energy that his friend does, but every second grader and every student wants attention. So is there ever a case where they'll pretend that they have these issues because they want attention? Also, they also want to be called out. They also want to be monitored every day.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we have it by children, too. You know, I'm sure we all experience the easy child becomes the difficult child because we put so much into the difficult children, and then the easy child says, hello, I'm here. So I think that really that has to be a balance. And if you do, like, sometimes I'll do, like, these little charts for a couple of boys that need it. But then I'll also do it for a boy that doesn't really need it but could use it. And it's, and I kind of sense it, especially if he asks me, what is that? And how do you get that prize? So I'll quickly, you know, do up a chart for him. But
you,
that's
so you
a,
have to focus on the
it's a great point, 100%.
Okay, so we'll read the last question. It seems as though all throughout Klal Yisrael, most families are not immune to some member of their immediate or extended family dealing with some issue, some bigger, some smaller. That being said, the break the stigma does not seem to really be working. As much as we continue to say it, truth be told, despite everyone dealing with something, it always comes back to shidduchim. Shidduchim, shidduchim. How can it ever really become normalized if this is how our global community continues to address this? So if each one of you could address this for a minute.
I want to know who the people are.
I don't
are.
Have any easy answers.
That's a big one. We have the same question.
What?
That's what you would say, right?
That's what I would say. Yeah, I want to know who the people are. Like the people that they're, that were almost like glorifying what they think or what they say or what they're doing. Like, I mean, honestly, maybe I'm mistaken. I mean, I got married 11 years. My friend is making a bar mitzvah. I have a 1-year-old. Like, you know, that's kind of like been my experience in Shidduchim. So I might be too close to it to answer, but I would just say, like, did I want the guy who only wanted a girl who didn't have a not from sister-in-law? Like, is that a thing? If it's a thing, by all means, judge me for it and then don't marry me. Like, I didn't, there's only so much, control you have over life. And someone who's like a real like Yerei Shamayim, which is what I wanted, and then these people who are super judgmental on the other end with like, and my husband standing in the back smiling at me, like the like is that a component that I'm really concerned about, like the mental health of his niece? Like, I don't know that that makes it, I mean, his niece is gorgeous and beautiful and perfect, but I'm just thinking, I know he's like, what do you think about my niece? No, but like, that's a real thing also. Like, why are we judging that? Where's that coming from? So when, in the question, if you could just repeat the question.
It was a really long one.
Yes, so just repeat the one about the community piece. Or everyone, there was an everyone piece. Or everything comes with something?
As much as we continue to say it, truth be told, despite everyone dealing with something, it always comes back to Shidduchim. How can it ever really become normalized if this is how our global community continues to address this?
Right, so who's the global community? And is that something that you are... that you? I think it needs to be like a conscious... to see that it's a conscious choice. Like, I am choosing to accept this person as my Shidduchim, even if they have like a skewed perspective on whatever. And I think that that's something that people don't allow themselves... to think about. I mean, I was very much privy to this for years and years, people telling me I needed to switch my resume, I needed to switch my picture, I needed to switch my this, I needed to go get a master's. Did you get your master's yet? Until you get your master's, we can't set you up. Like, what is it? I'll talk to you in 10 years when you're married. It ripped me apart. I mean, I can speak about it openly now. I'm the one. I'm the one who's now... now I'm the one who's coming to talk about my trauma. No, the truth is... the truth is that it really happens in a very raw way, that it rips at people who don't really... who don't deserve it, who don't need it, and usually were the most functional of the people who are struggling with all of it. Like, that I need to answer back to a shop. So I'm like, I need to be in therapy for 7 years because people are thinking that I'm crazy. Like... I don't know. That's my response. That's not really a response, but I would just say, like, check who you're following or not following. I know. I'm sorry. I'm taking too much
time. Rabbi Gross, you want to say something?
The question's a good question.
I would just say we can't control or change global attitudes necessarily, but we can work on ourselves. So one at a time, person by person. You know, you work to not be that person who stigmatizes somebody else. You work to be the person who is kind and non-judgmental and accepting when somebody shares something with you that they are scared to share because they don't know your reaction. And then you be the person who says, that's okay. I have that experience in my own family too. And then you're slowly going to build bridges and reduce stigma one person at a time because you can't do it globally.
I find it interesting about the stigma that, you know, if somebody, you know, like, let's say has OCD or their mother has, you know, bipolar or something else, that's like, the minute you hear that, you know, like, oh my gosh, I can't set my son or my daughter up with that family, it's like, no way, you know? But the thing is, though, what I find interesting is that coming off our grandparents, coming off the heels of the Holocaust, and that, you know, I'm not a child of the Holocaust, but I know enough people who are, that, you know, the two G's or whatever, I mean, their parents were, like, you know, screaming in the middle of the night, you know, doing all this, maybe, like, you know, what they felt like crazy behavior, and so the children of this are traumatized from their own parents because of their own trauma. I mean, it is, like, the biggest post-PTSD, you know, losing parents and all this kind of stuff that has, like, hit our generation in any generation, and then we've got a stigma about mental illness. I mean, it's like sitting right underneath our nose.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. It's just my...
That's a good point. I'll just weigh in with one word. I'm sorry. You know, it's time. I think over time, that stigma is dropping. I don't think we're there yet. I agree.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of shalom bias issues because of all these hidden or cured, issues. Everyone was cured because, you know, they got to get cured right before they go out. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, they're engaged. And then the stress of marriage comes. And it all comes back with a fury. And unfortunately, a lot of divorces, which, you know, as much as there's a shidduch crisis, there's a divorce crisis as well, and maybe even more so. And a lot of that is with mental health issues, even though it's not talked about.
Right.
That we're not told about and not disclosed.
And not treated.
And that's the main thing. Because of the stigma, people aren't treating it. They think they're okay. And then they don't know how to deal with it. And, you know, and it's not fair to a spouse. It's not fair to, you know, to a family. And it all goes back to that stigma. But like Ravelis is saying, I think time, it's a slow process. You know?
Yeah.
I guess to end on a good note, this would have never happened 4 years ago. A panel discussion like this, and I mean, we when I started NALA in 2014, we were getting about 8 calls a month, and now we're getting over 50 calls a month, and that's between. I didn't say it, but it just shows the community is looking and reaching out for help, and all the clinicians have been a tremendous help for us. And I've been told many times from other cities that people have said that our clinicians in our community are the most accessible. That you could call them. I'm not getting out their cell phone numbers, but really, it's unheard of in other communities that the professionals will give the amount of time that they give to people just to run things by. Like Mrs. Lubin said before, you could talk them to screen things, but I think it's out there. People are talking about it. The stigma has not been removed yet, but more people are talking about it, and we're here to help. If anybody has any other questions, feel free to call our office. Mrs. Hershkowitz is in the clinician. She's in the office, could help with any of these questions. And I really, really appreciate all your time, Rabbi Gross, and all the panelists. You guys are extremely very, very, very busy, and thank you for taking this time to help us. Thank you. Thank you.
Can I do 30 to 49?
Can you what?
Can I do 30 to
49? No.
The saddest thing. Oh, you do this on purpose. I'm sure you know that.
I didn't even fill it out. Hang on 1 second. I just wanted to note to you to know that I wrote this down.
I don't know if we got to everything.
They described it past the
and then I called it trauma.
Yeah, but I think they're treating it as trauma.
Oh, yeah? Okay, perfect. I don't know if it's important. I'm kind of like...
Yeah, Jenny's with it, which is totally doing that work. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good call.
Okay,
570. Okay. I'm Roger. You doing this. So,
I'm gonna get to my job.